All right, what is up, everybody? This is Alex once again with the EOT Newsflash Network. This is episode 37, Alex and the Wandering Bards, with our debut album, Listen to the Warping Wail. And I'm joined with my bards tonight. We've got Justin Forkenrath Aristocrat. What's going on, Justin?
Not much. Doing good.
And what a province of the multiverse do you hail from, oh ye bard of Forkenrath?
Definitely Ravnica is where I'm going to call home.
Okay, all right. That's pretty cool. And we also have the lovely bard, Stephen Spellpierce. How's it going, Stephen?
It's going pretty well. Glad to be back, finally.
Yeah. Hailing from the plane of many turns.
That's acceptable.
And before we get started tonight, Stephen, so you've been kind of absent from some of our episodes recently because you've been working on a science thing, and this has nothing to do with magic, but I want you to tell everybody at home, just for some diversity in content and, you know, topics, about your science thing.
Okay, so at Texas Tech, we have what are called project labs for the electrical engineering department. And so each lab, we're given a project to create, and we go and we have the entire semester to do it. So this semester, my partners and I were working on creating a transmitter and receiver system that will tell you what the temperature is, you know, however far away you decide you want to put the transmitter. Our design criteria was for 50 feet. But our professor said our system was good enough, we probably could have gotten a mile out of it if we were using the right antennas.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
So that was pretty awesome. And so like what it did is we used we transmitted across 13.56 megahertz, which you can – if you're into like ham radio and things like that, that's in the FCC part 40 – Section 47, Part 15, I believe, is like where you can get the like requirements for that.
Sure.
And it was a lot of fun. Designing that project took a bit, and we used Morse code as our way to transmit the signal and relay the information to the user.
Very cool. Because I saw the video of it, and I heard the beeping, and I tried to make sense of what it was actually doing, but I just couldn't. So I was curious.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. Our professor had suggested we use Morse code because it simplified the circuitry that we needed to use. And then in our final presentation, he goes, "All right, so what's the practicality of having a commercial device use Morse code?" And we're like, but.
So we totally punked you guys.
Yeah, a little bit. But I mean, we got the project working, and we basically showed that if we wanted to, we could adapt it to another method that could better interact with the user.
That's still pretty sweet, though. But college professors punking their students is pretty classic. I like it. All right, so that's a Stephen's science corner for the night. But we've actually got a pretty great show to go into tonight. Got a couple of user-submitted topics because I was literally out of ideas for this week until I read a pretty good article from Saffron Alvolov over on MTG Goldfish, which kind of inspired all of tonight's episode. But we're talking about personal theme music. You know, when you go to a tournament, you know, you have your headphones in, what are you jamming to? The newly announced Magic D&D, I believe they're calling it Planeshift D&D, which is a magic campaign, but it's set with D&D rules. And then we've also got an upcoming idea of mine to talk about blocks that I started playing with. So I started playing back in Mirrodin and Besieged and doing a block-by-block review of each one of those and kind of, you know, up to our modern era. And finally, kind of finishing up with the article I mentioned earlier by Saffron Olive that talks about the reprint viability of modern cards in standard sets. It was prompted by a question on Mark Rosewater's blogatog, in which somebody basically said, you know, can we do this? And he replied in a very sort of ambiguous way, as Mark Rosewater's wanted to do. But let's go ahead and talk about theme music for a second. So you guys have all been to tournaments, right? GPs, SCG Opens, whatever it's going to be. And you've got your headphones in. What is it? What kind of music are you guys listening to get you ready to sling some spells and walk some planes? I'm going to start with Justin.
You know, honestly, I'm more of one to center myself with silence. But if I had to pick
boring.
A song, hey, you know, I got to get into that Zen moment. But if I was going to pick a song, I'd pick Underdog by Audio Adrenaline. You could also pick Underdog by Imagine Dragons. I'm new to the competitive scene. I'm playing, you know, Delver, which is an Underdog deck, and I just kind of love the feeling of doing better than I'm supposed to.
Could you also go with the Underdog theme song from the Underdog cartoon from
the '60s? Probably could.
Underdog. Speed of lightning, sound of thunder, Underdog.
And didn't they bring that back in one of the recent cartoons? I think, like, late 2000s?
I know they made a movie about it that was terrible.
Yeah, didn't they have, like, the guy from Corey's in the House?
I don't even know what that is. But I want to say that they... I'm gonna look it up.
The little brother from That's So Raven.
I don't even know what that is.
Old Disney shows from when I was like 10 years old.
Nope, there was only the Underdog cartoon from the 60s until 1973.
Interesting.
Yeah. But there was a movie. Oh, the theme song, written by Chester Stover. All right, anyway. What about you, Steven? What are you listening to kind of hype yourself up for a tournament?
So typically, I'll actually just hang out with friends and chat, because that's like how I like to get ready. I like to psych everyone else up, and that gets me psyched. But whenever I am alone and I'm listening to music, I'll typically listen to my Newsboy station on Pandora. And my favorite song is Shine. And so that just gets me going, and it puts me in a really good mood.
That takes me back to my, like, the early 90s of my childhood. Mm-hmm. And I had my Walkman CD player.
With its anti-skip technology.
Yes. and a carrying case full of CDs in my backpack.
Yeah.
Because to all of our, you know, younger fans out there, you used to not be able to listen to 10,000 songs on one little device. You had to carry around things called CDs.
Back in my day.
And the best, though, was getting CDs burned from friends and stuff, so that way you all, like, had the same stuff.
Oh, yeah. I can blame a lot of people in my some of my high school classes for burning me some of the music that kind of shaped my current musical leanings.
And then, of course, there was always the mixed CD for the girl.
Yeah, I did a few of those.
I did a couple.
I did a few of those.
Some were more successful than others.
you see all our young fans out there. In the past, to get a girl's attention, you had to give her a music mix. You know, and if you're doing like on a stereo, like a cassette recorder, you had to like wait for the song to come on the radio and hope you don't clip off like the very first second of the intro and not get, you know, the faded out into the commercial break. Yeah. Dating was hard back then. There was a real struggle.
The struggle was real.
It was real. On the opposite side of the spectrum for myself, when I'm the few times I actually ever had my headphones, I haven't had them, and I always kind of feel sort of unprepared about having to look at them and zone myself in. At the extreme opposite of the spectrum from Steven and Justin, I listen to a lot of very abrasive black metal, and so I've been really digging the albums by Cobalt and Lord Mantis. If any metal fans are out there, you know, throwing their double horns up right now, you're welcome. But I just like something that just gets got like a really unrelenting, just that just wants to pound you into the ground and just really.
Darkness. No parents.
Because Batman's a true artist, guys.
No parents.
But just something that like kind of like, you know, just like kind of get like the energy level up in me. I want something that's kind of, you know, that's gonna mentally just kind of like work me up, and then all this built up tension. Now I start, you know, just ripping spells and throwing lightning bolts and stuff like that. So yeah, something. I'd be curious to know if anybody else out there listens to anything different. I know a good friend of ours, James Black, listens to a lot of rap, ratchet music, as he calls it, to kind of get himself in the mood. Which is always fun. We were actually at a draft last night together, and he had that on, and it's jarring at some points. But that's all I'll say about that. So yeah, that's personal theme music. If you guys have a, you know, a station or a band you guys like to listen to, you know, definitely let us know and share with us your thoughts and all that good stuff. But let's go ahead and move on to something that Justin, I know, is really excited about, and I do mean really excited about, and that's the Planeshift Magic D&D campaign that's set on the plane of Zendikar. So, Justin, what on earth are they doing here? Just kind of give us, like, for anybody who doesn't know, give us a brief overview of what the heck Planeshift Zendikar actually is.
Okay, so Planeshift Zendikar is essentially an opportunity for the Dungeons & Dragons players that happen to also play Magic to be able to play in these amazing worlds that we've been able to read about, see cards about, and just, like, kind of imagine ourselves experiencing. But now we get to actually do a full-blown D&D campaign in Zendikar, which is a great jumping-off set. The original Zendikar set was all about adventures, all about these quests, and it had a very D&D high fantasy feel to it. So I think this is the perfect plane to start us off in. They give us tons of new information about the world, and in conjunction with everything that we know from reading the stories that they post online, like, we can make a full-fledged campaign world. In addition, they provide us with some rules for some of the races that are prominent within the Zendikar plane. So the Merfolk, the Kor, the humans, the goblins.
And the vampires.
Oh, and the vampires, you are right.
Because you got a sparkle.
We also have some new creatures to represent the various monstrosities on Zendikar.
Yep.
All in all, it looks like a great time to be had. I haven't had a chance to really dive into this yet, but from what I've seen, everything feels balanced. Everything feels appropriate. Everything's given enough flavor to even someone who's never read the magic stories, they've never seen the cards, they're going to be able to look at this book and be able to make a very accurate, educated guess on what Zendikar is like for DMing a campaign of their own.
Dangerous. That's how I summarize Zendikar in D&D terms.
It is an incredibly dangerous plane, which is one of the things that makes it rather exciting. I'm hoping that this gains enough popularity and traction that we see one in Ravnica.
Yeah, that would be sweet. That'd be very sweet.
That'd be really awesome, because then you get the guild alignments too.
Yeah.
And then you could have, like, inner party disputes because of the guilds. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I like, the very little that I know about D&D, I've run a handful of campaigns in my lifetime. I like the fact that they're kind of equating some of the bigger monsters to things like Krakens and Beholders and just, like, the bigger, more, you know, iconic monsters.
Absolutely.
Of D&D to the Eldrazi. And I do want to point out really quickly, they have the art for Oracle of Dust on here, and I never noticed that the little people that he's holding onto are quite small. Oracle of Dust is huge and terrifying.
Oh my gosh, I've never noticed that before. Huh.
But anyway, it's very big and very creepy. But yeah, this looks really cool, and I'm really wanting to get together a campaign of some kind. So if you are interested in joining in on that, it would probably have to be done in person. But something, you know, over the summer, because we're kind of getting to that point in the year, the school year at least, to really sit down and run a campaign like this, I'm going to do my best at my attempt of DMing. So that'll be great. All prepared to die.
And gladly volunteer to co-DM to pull the reins back so that the party can actually live past the first session.
What, you mean I just can't get like Dark Souls and have you all die?
No.
All the time?
No, you don't wake up, rocks fall, you die. It's no fun that way.
But that sounds like fun. Anyway.
you only kill them when they roll a one, like on the easiest check of their life.
Yeah, exactly. you tripped over a rock and died. It was a small rock, but you died.
We gotta make it more extravagant than that. Like, there was like a poisonous caterpillar that their face fell onto or something.
Ooh, that is epic. Yeah. Yeah, wasn't there a caterpillar in BFZ? Like, caustic caterpillar? Or was that in
Origins? I think that was Origins.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll have some cross-planar activity, I guess. That'd be great. But yeah, this looks really cool. Like I said, I've played a handful of D&D. I've run some Star Wars campaigns before with some friends of mine. But this looks like a lot of fun, just because it is a world that we all know and we have maybe want to experience. Justin used a very curious word, imagination. I don't know if that's something that all Magic players have, other than just their competitive killer edge. But yeah, I'm sure we can all find something, you know, to imagine, whatever that is. But yeah, it's pretty cool. And the last thing that we're going to touch on before we get to the big main topic of the evening is an idea I had recently with all of the downtime that we've just had copious amounts of. You know, there hasn't been a new set, you know, spoiled anything like that. And I don't want to just, do a week after week of just tournament reports and things like that. I wanted to do something a little bit different, and I decided that it might be interesting to do block by block retrospective reviews, starting with the point that I started playing Magic, which was Mirrodin Besiegel, the point where I got back into Magic, I should say, and do a review of each set within each block, you know, as a full episode, and really dig into the lore, the big cards, the flavor, the mechanics, and things like that, you know, the big decks of the time, and then kind of give it our, you know, our general grade of, you know, was this a good set? What were the lasting impacts of this set? And there's a couple of more recent sets that really drive, that have a very negative lasting impact, but created a very positive outcome because of that impact. And I'll let you guys kind of ponder what that might mean. And once we get to that set, I'll let you guys know what I think. Spoilers, it's in Tarkir. So yeah, Justin, I know you played back in Time Spiral and then got back in right before Gatecrash, I think? Or Archer Block?
It was the... Where I started back up again was Theros. Pre-release. And I lasted up till... was it Journey to Nyx or Born of the Gods, which was the final pre-release for that block?
Journey to Nyx.
Okay. So I played all three of those pre-releases. I was playing casually at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like, a lot of people hate that block. A lot of people hate it.
For good reason, too.
And now maybe just because I was at the casual level, I was playing at a local game shop, wasn't going to any tournament, you know, no big tournaments, just like Friday Night Magic, pre-release, draft events and whatnot. I had a lot of fun with it. It was actually the first time that I had played a blue deck. I was playing an Izzet Scry Burn deck built around Flamespeak Adept and Aqueous Form and Thassa. And just kind of like abusing the fact that every time I scry, this Flamespeaker Adept gets huge. And it was a lot of fun. It did very well at Wild West Comics when I was playing it, and just every time I cast Aqueous Form on Flamespeaker Adept, I just felt like the best Magic player in the room.
Seems good. That sounds like a deck that you would enjoy playing, Steven.
Yeah.
Zany combos that do weird things at weird times with different mechanics.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I enjoy. Oh, man. So... I was going to play Battle of Wits tonight at our Legacy event, but I decided to, you know, come record with you guys. But, yeah, no, I even have that for Legacy set up. So
that sounds like an acceptable reason not to record on any given night. So go play Battle of Wits and Legacy.
No, it's okay. To be fair, it's proxied. I wish I had the $10,000 to drop on it. That'd be just, you know, fantastic. But, no, let's be real.
Oh, that'd be... Damn.
It's like... It's fantastic. It's basically just throwing three decks together, adding Battle of Wits combo cards, and calling it a day.
Just call it a day. Yep. Speaking of big financial drops, I read an article today. I forget what site it was from, but they called it the Seven Deadly Sins, and it was the seven they chose was Lust, and it was about the $78,000 Commander deck.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was a Bant themed sort of Planeswalker control deck, and the idea was to use the most expensive version of every card they put in the deck. So, Foil Russian Jace the Mind Sculptor, apparently $13,000 of some kind. You know, misprinted for whatever reason. Like, the deck was absurd.
Wow.
Justin just had a heart attack. But yeah, so... And Simo, you got back into around Gatecrash, right?
No. Well, that's whenever I started playing competitively. I first got into Magic in right before Return to... Or wait, no, sorry. Yeah, right before Return to Ravnica. It was the summer before, so it was like that July. So right after, what was that, M12? Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds all right. So be cool to just kind of like get your... As a brand new player coming into a situation like that, what did you think about Magic coming into that? So I think it'd be kind of a cool sort of look back at, you know, where we've come to where we are now in Magic. I think it would be a pretty neat thing to do. But let's go ahead and move on to the big topic of the night. And that's going to be the article that was written by Saffron Olive earlier this week over on MTG Goldfish. And it's basically called Storm Scaling Potential Modern Reprints. And like I said earlier, this was prompted by a question to Mark Rosewater on his Blogatog. And it basically, they asked him, you know, what are the odds of printing modern staples in standard legal sets? And Mark was already using his sort of storm scale, you know, the higher up on the storm scale it goes, the less chance it has of being reprinted ever. And his basic response was, the vast majority of cards that matter in modern that are powerful enough to be relevant in a format with that many cards will horribly warp standard. And that sounds a little bit like hyperbole, but what Saffron Olive did was he kind of broke it down into five different tiers, actually, and showed us that that's not actually all that true. So we're going to kind of dig through ours as well and break down these levels and kind of give our thoughts on these individual levels. So the levels that he has laid out for us are level 0, which are currently or recently legal and standard, and that includes cards that are standard legal or recently rotated. That's redundant what I just said there. Level 1 is dual lands, because they kind of get their own category since there are a bunch of them, and they are among the most 100 expensive cards in modern. And next we've got our level 2, which is the safe cards, which are, they can include cards that are fine in nearly all standard formats. There can be some rare situations where you have things like Scapeshift that haven't been a standard rotation with Valakut that might create an issue, but they're otherwise safe to reprint that, and they wouldn't warp a standard format. Next we've got the level 3, which is borderline cards, which include a couple of different types of cards. First are the ones that Saffron himself thought were kind of on the fence, and the second were cards that are based on the format. So things like Eye of Ugin, if it were to be printed in standard right now, would just completely destroy standard, for that example. And then level 4 are the absolutely unsafe cards that would just kind of be printed in a standard format and destroy standard as we know it. Now, that being said, he thinks that there's a way to design standard so that those cards wouldn't destroy the format, but just kind of using the current design philosophy of Wizards, printing a card that we'll get to here a little bit would just break a format. And the one kind of caveat we need to make here is that those he was using for modern reprints are focused more on price than playability. So instead of using the most played card, which includes things like Lightning Bolt and Serum Vision for commons effectively, we want to see the 100 most expensive cards and break those down into those five categories. So Steven, since I know you play a lot of blue decks and a lot of standard, and you love Jace, right? Everybody loves Jace.
He's a bro.
he's a bro. So let's start with level zero, and that's the cards that are currently in standard. And so things like Jace Sprint, Prodigy, Ugin the Spirit Dragon, Kalidus, Collected Company, and some more kind of recent rotating cards that have rotated out, Monastery Mentor, Court of Calling, Urborg, Ulamog, and Gideon. Kind of what are your thoughts on cards that are on this power level that have broken into modern and their place in standard?
Well, I think that like whenever you're designing a set, you should design a couple cards for the older formats, just in so much as that you're showing them attention. I mean, what, like Legacy's gotten Delver, Thespian Stage, and a couple others recently. And, you know, Modern's really been changed a lot by Jace, Ugin, and Collected Company. And, you know, I think that's a good thing to have. Now, as far as, like, their power level and standard, I think that I would love if they just, you know, if they let the reins loose and they're like, all right, here are these really powerful cards. There isn't one color that is like clearly advantaged in all of this. Go have some fun and, you know, enjoy playing the game. Like, and I understand that like whenever you do that for each color, you're going to create like really high like prices for a couple of those cards.
Sure.
But even then, like, I feel that, you know, for the people who enjoy like opening packs, like there's more to open, which is, you know, nice for them as well. And I don't know. Anything that takes out variance to a degree, I think is cool because you get to really test the skill of the player. Now, I completely understand why, you know, like luck is a factor in the game, and I do enjoy that aspect of it. But whenever you really get to the nitty gritty of it, I think the game should revolve more around how skillful you are rather than how consistently lucky you are.
Yeah. Yeah, and he kind of makes a really interesting point about Jace. You know, he's currently in standard, obviously in standard. But he goes as far as saying that just because it's in standard doesn't mean that a card is safe. Like, Justin, would you agree that Jace, Mentor, Prodigy is a standard warping card?
It definitely was before this past rotation.
Right. So, like, with Fetchlands in the picture, let's kind of look at him from his first printing or Origins. Fetchlands were a thing, you know. Then it becomes a problem, I think. Now less so.
Yeah. Now, Jace definitely warped the format when he was first. Well, not when he was first printed. No one realized how good he was at first.
Yeah.
But once people did. You know, he definitely had a huge impact on the format. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, though.
To have a card be,
you know, impactful. Now, I don't think he'll ever be reprinted because these Origins, Planeswalkers types are very, very story-heavy cards, and it would be very strange to see, you know, in Return to Ravnica 3... you know, a Vryn's Prodigy or something like that.
Right, but like if we remove sort of the story factor just from a reprint, because, you know, when eventually he broke out of a standard, could, like, because he is so powerful in Modern, in Legacy, and even to an extent Vintage, he could potentially fall into one of these other tiers as this might be a bad idea of seeing him show up again in standard.
I mean, I guess I can see that. It's just hard for me to judge that on Planeswalkers since they rarely reprint Planeswalkers anyways.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But
I think that for Jaces in particular, most of all Jaces, they shine bright enough in their one time to prove that this shouldn't happen again.
That's fair.
And then we've got a card like Collected Company, which probably just is the best card in Standard because it goes and gets Jace. It goes and gets Bounding Crassus. It goes and gets Tireless Tracker. And it hits so much of the color pie and just one very good full value deck. You could probably make the argument that it is too good for Standard, but it's a good value card. You know, Steven, you said exactly the same thing. You know, it's okay to have good cards in Standard, and I think this is a very good example of that.
The only time I think that Collected Company was a problem was when Four Color Rally existed.
Sure, yeah.
Because, like, Collected Company is only as good as the creatures you're fetching.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So when we had the Four Color Rally degenerate, you know, I don't even want to get into how I feel about that deck, but you know, that was the only time it was a problem. This Bank Coco list is sweet. It's a fair deck.
Yeah.
And it's fun to play, and it's fun to play against. So, like, once again, I don't see an issue with Collected Company. It warps the format, but in a fun way.
Right. But now let's look at it from the lens of being in Modern, because right now, Abzan Coco is one of the best decks in the format, being able to just kill your opponent with infinite life or infinite damage on turn four, effectively. Or three if you go, you know, accelerate from Bird of Paradise. From that kind of a standpoint, would you? It becomes more a problem in an older format. It becomes better in older formats.
Absolutely.
And I don't think you'd want to see a card like this show up again in the near future, just because for reprint's sake, for Modern.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about a straight reprint, then we're not worrying about. We don't have to worry about a functional reprint where they get more cards that are doing this. I think that Collected Company, in terms of Standard, is a fine card. It becomes ridiculous in Modern, where you have the better creatures.
Yeah.
Where it can get a Goyf, or an infinite life combo, or something like that.
Yeah. But I definitely wouldn't... I don't want to see these cards come back in Standard, personally.
Mm-hmm.
But then we've got cards kind of like Court of Calling. Didn't really do anything in Standard as far as I can remember, did it?
Well, it was paired in the Hornet Queen deck. Like, it was played alongside, what was it, Green-Black Constellation, I think, ran a couple.
Sure, yeah. But as far as, like, in older formats, it's absolutely absurd in Modern, where it is literally just tap some creatures and go get whatever creature it is. It's more powerful than Collected Company in that regard. You have a card such as Kolaghan's Command, which is infinitely better in Modern than it is in Standard. And so it's cards like this that I think that are a little bit safer to actually bring back at some point. You know, obviously for flavor reasons, it's hard to reprint Kolaghan's Command in a set that doesn't have Kolaghan.
Yeah.
So I think that cards that are better in Modern are safe to reprint, and you know, this is a good category for that. So things like Ulamog, which the Ceaseless Hunger, which sees play in Modern Tron right now, and Monastery Mentor, which sees print in much older formats like Vintage. You have cards that, if they're better in an older format, they're much safer to reprint in Standard because they just won't do anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would like to point out with this is that a lot of these stronger cards are becoming story-oriented, which I know we're not really considering story, you know, when we're talking about these reprints, but Ulamog the Ceaseless Hunger, Ulamog's dead now.
Yeah.
We're never going to see another, presumably, we're never going to see another Ulamog again. You know, a Gideon ally of Zendikar. This is when he's, like, working with the allies on Zendikar.
Sure.
Fantastic card in white-black tokens. Probably never going to see it printed again simply because of the story impact.
Yeah.
And Kolaghan's Command, like you just mentioned, without Kolaghan, there is no K-Kan.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think because of the more focus that Wizards has put on the story limit of developing sets, Justin makes a really good point there. Just like these cards just won't ever see another printing unless it is a minorly different reprint, like a functional reprint at that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to think that because the core sets are gone, we won't get reprints like this. Because if we had the core sets, like Kolaghan's Command would be fine.
Yeah.
Because they don't really have to worry so much about the story. They can focus on, oh, it was relevant for such and such planeswalker to know this at this given time.
Yeah, exactly. And so they can kind of like disregard the whole, because core sets didn't have a story. Like, they had a theme.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know,
and
find the reprint.
Yeah, we're never going to see Orbog again unless we go to Dominaria.
Yeah, which was printed in a core set, yeah. Or Time Spiral, which is where it was printed in as well. So yeah, it's really interesting to just kind of look at, you know, cards that are dominating Standard right now, but from a older format lens and see where they kind of fall. But let's move on to the first kind of standalone category here, and that's dual lands. And basically, when you look at the most expensive cards in Modern, you look at your land base. So your fetch lands, your man lands, your utility lands, they're all absurdly expensive because of reasons, I guess.
So can I add in a quick disclaimer there?
Sure.
All right. The most expensive cards in decks, period, will most likely be your lands.
That is true. That is true. And so basically, you kind of have to break them down into two parts, dual lands and actual utility lands. And we could probably see a strong cycle of these be reprinted in every standard set and not have it ruin things. The fetch lands we've seen kind of caused a problem because we're playing four color nonsense decks, but that's because we had the battle lands that we could actually go and actually build these 4 and 5 color mana bases. The man lands are perfectly fine, even though the new ones suck compared to the old ones, I think. And then you've got lands like, we're not really counting like Cavern of Souls here. We're talking about true dual lands in the most sense. So the quality of them obviously impacts how good they are in standard. So like the current ones, that all the decks are running the two color, like the blue red uncommon land from Shadows of Innistrad. It's kind of your bottom tier of mana fixing, but it's good enough. So I think as long as Wizards is happy to reprint cards like this to bring the price down. Scalding Tarn is $80. Grave of the Burnals is $70. As long as they're willing to kind of put these cards back into circulation, it's not unreasonable to think that we'll just see these cards at some point in the future.
Like I would love to see the Zendikar Fetches reprinted.
Eternal Masters.
I mean, in standard.
Eternal just, Masters. Oh, wait. Never mind. That's not going to be standard.
GG. I would like to see that happen. I just would rather see it reprinted in a format that has something like the Czech land, where it's a dual land, but it doesn't have the word island or mountain on it.
Oh yeah, like the M10 buddy lands.
Yeah.
Dragon Catacomb, the Dragon Soul Summit, things like that. Sure.
Yeah, or the Innistrad ones as well.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so even though we just had like the crazy fetch battle land mana bases, I still feel like that it wasn't... Okay, so the mana base wasn't the overbearing part. It was like what you were able to do with it, like with the cards that were like given at that time. And like it was kind of cool that you were able to just take like Abzan, for instance, and you could either be Abzan Red or Mardu Green, like depending on like what main focus you wanted to be on.
Yeah.
So like the splash ability I thought was interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily say that like that's problematic for a format. Like, I think that's the type of format that you're going to be designing towards if you're going to have the larger color pie available to a given deck.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, other than Atarka Red and Rally, most of those decks were the same deck that changed out, like, 5 cards.
Yeah.
So, like, Abzan Red, Mardu Green, Jeskai Black. I mean, these were basically the same deck over and over again, with a couple of like little flex spots changed and the mana base being mildly different. Which is why I was disappointed by the end of the format before the fetches rotated out.
Yeah, it was part of the big reason that I stopped playing Standard, was I just got tired of sitting down and going, okay, you're playing Siege Rhinos, and you're also playing Butcher of the Horde all in the same deck with a bunch of efficient removal spells, and your mana base is perfect. Like, that's... It becomes less a game of... I understand that Magic has become... The pendulum of Magic design is swinging much more towards creature battles. Spells are no longer, the ruler of the day. And I had a good conversation with my friend David Palmer last night, and he mentioned the point, that back in the day, he could sit down against, a younger player, and it's kind of a once-over example here, sit down against, 12-year-old, and it wasn't even a game. Like, no chance at all. But now, the same 12-year-old within the context of the format that we're currently in, or, Khan's Block standard, the same kid now has access to the same power level of cards that David had, And if he can just play them in the right order, you know, sequence them properly, he's going to win the game. You know, it doesn't, it's not a game of skill anymore. It's more of just, you know, this card has so much value attached to it that I'm just not going to lose. Like, Siege Runner is so good as what it does, I just can't lose. Yeah. And so,
and I think it's fine to have powerful creatures, but that we shouldn't have powerful creatures at the expense of powerful cards.
Sure, yeah.
Or, sorry, powerful spells.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because I think Magic should cater to both, because some people love jamming creatures. When I first started playing, like, creatures were my thing.
But then he casts a Sphinx's Revelation. Right,
actually,
Steven?
I have never cast a Sphinx's Revelation yet. Have not had that opportunity.
And this is the same guy that, like, not even an hour ago said, Alex, I think I want to change my Doubler deck into a control deck for Modern. I'll give you a Sphinx's Revelation.
Oh, okay.
But you will have the
welcome
best
to the fold.
Yeah. With the madness cost, too.
You know,
yeah.
That's what it takes to play control. We have to be all a little bit mad.
I think that both styles of players should have that opportunity.
Sure.
And I think Magic needs to stop doing this swing where it's like, here's our powerful spells, our creatures are garbage. Oh, hey, things are pretty close. Oh, now our creatures are busted and our spells are worthless. Let's stay closer to that meeting.
Yeah. And of course the mana bases are gonna help us do that. Obviously, ones that come into play untapped promote more of an aggro tempo style of play, but ones that come into, you know, more tapped dual lands promote more grinding control mid-range strategies. As long as we have a good mix of these things that are constantly being reprinted, I mean, I think we can all agree that the Shadows Under Innistrad lands kind of suck.
I think they're okay.
Compared to, like, the old ones.
Yeah. I agree with that. I definitely would say, like, my initial view of them has improved, like, after actually, like, playing, sitting down and playing with them.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
But, like, I don't know, I just think it's part of the format. Like, the format is just a tad bit slower unless you're playing white or bank company.
Mono white, exactly.
Yeah.
And for me, like, the Shadowlands feel on a similar power level, slightly weaker, but similar power level to the Fastlands. I mean, if you get it in your opening hand, you probably have another land you can reveal.
Yep.
If you've drawn it late, not ideal, but, you know, you've already got lands on the field. It's not going to ruin things for you. Usually.
Yeah, it just creates interesting subgames of how to sequence your lands and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as long as Wizards doesn't throw, you know, all of the design sensibility out the window and say, oh, this land's coming to play tapped unless you reveal two lands from your hand, or you have to have four basic lands in play where you're going to untap. As long as you don't get stupid with, you know, design restrictions,
mm-hmm.
dual lands, I think, are fine. But they're the heart of every format, period.
Exactly.
But let's kind of head and move on to the second, or the third tier, actually. And these are the cards that are safe, barring an unfit environment. And the very first one that's at the top of the list, and it's one that I think is the best example of this, is Scapeshift. Now, it's kind of like, preface this, these are the cards that are safe to reprint, but as we're going to see, there are some examples like Scapeshift that basically say this cannot be reprinted within a certain environment. So you can reprint Scapeshift. It's a terrible Magic card. I mean, let's get that out right of the way. Like, it's bad, right?
Yeah.
It's a card that I hope to see reprinted in Modern Masters 3 or Eternal Masters just because it's so bad, but it needs to be reprinted because it's $50 and I want to play Scapeshift. But if you're playing in a deck with Valakut the Molten Pinnacle, it's the best card in the world, essentially. So we've had exactly one standard that Valakut was actually legal in. So that's one point in time that Scapeshift would have been unsafe in standard. So all the other times, completely safe in standard. And so a reprint of Scapeshift might not make any sense within the context of the game. You know, if what Scapeshift does from a flavor perspective does something cool within the context of the next block, great, reprint it. Fantastic. But as long as Valakut doesn't show up at any point during that block, it's completely fine.
I will say a Scapeshift in conjunction with the Tireless Tracker could be absolutely horrifying.
Okay, sure. Yeah, something like that. That's pretty cool, though.
Oh, no, absolutely cool. But, and also not busted because, like, they then have to spend all the mana on those clues before they can.
Exactly. And you can still just bounce the damn thing with a Reflector Mage. Like, all that hard work and, oh, now your 14-14's gone. Oh, sorry. And so, you know, obviously, there are things like Landfall that would have kind of made this card dangerous. But for the most part, as long as you're designing intelligently and you look a little bit ahead and go, oh, there's Valakut, don't reprint Scapeshift. We're okay.
And I think in a Landfall, like, this would have been a great card to reprint in BFZ with Landfall. It might have actually made Landfall a competitive strategy.
Oh, yeah, because it started out as a running Landfall was an okay deck until everybody realized that we can do just bigger, better things.
Exactly.
So let's kind of take a look at some of the other examples that you have here. Now, keep in mind, these are being reprinted in the context that this is a safe time to reprint them. So if you list a couple of lands here, so we have Glimmer Void, Flagstones of Troicare, Vesuva, Visage, Pendlehaven, Tendo Icebridge. These cards are all, you know, pushing the $15 mark that would just be fine in any kind of environment. You know, Glimmer Void, you can't reprint it in another Mirrodin block because it's just busted. But if you have a very small subset of artifacts in the format that makes this card pretty good, then you're safe. Monomo, if it had been legal with Dragonlord Ojutai,
cool.
Game over. Like, that's just the end of the format. I've played that in Modern, and it's the coolest thing ever.
It could also be pretty scary in, like, in a format with Kiki Jiki.
Yeah. Any legendary that has to do that taps for some ability makes Monomo completely busted.
Yeah.
I actually think that would have been actually really cool with Yisan, though.
Oh, my wandering bard Steven making the puns.
it actually would have been nifty.
It would have been very cool.
I mean, we got to put a Curious Follower, but having the ability on a land so it's not as fragile, like, I think that would have been cool.
Sure, yeah. Then we've got things like Vesuva, which copies a land and comes into play. As long as the lands you have in the format aren't just backbreaking like they had in, for example, the Summerbloom deck, Vesuva's completely safe to copy. I'm going to copy my Scry land. I'm going to copy my dual land. You know, things like that are fine. And we have to understand that not all utility lands are safe for Standard. You know, Mana Confluence, completely fine in Standard, but it wasn't warping by any stretch of the imagination.
Not enough people played five-color Flamespeaker.
Not enough people were cool enough like you, Steven.
No, they just did never give the deck a shot, see its potential.
That's fair. That is definitely fair. But do you guys agree with that as far as that's concerned? You know, these are all fine to say, the reprint, but they just can't be printed in the stupid context, right?
Yeah. Like, as long as you're not doing something absolutely retarded, you're fine.
Yeah. Like, can you imagine, Steven, you know, back when we had Six Revelation, if Besageu was legal?
No. Take me away, please. Like, it would have been a cool alternative for probably some deck, but having that in the mirror of control would have been just, ooh, man.
Thank God it's legendary, too. Otherwise, I'm going to put all these in my deck, and all my counter spells are completely untouchable. Magic is fun. And so let's look at some other cards. You know, things like Malira Silvok Outcast obviously kind of fits a certain theme. You know, she was back in Mirrodin. And as long as you look at your upcoming sets and it doesn't have Persist or Undying, go crazy. Reprint Malira. She's fantastic. Obviously, you know, it hates on Infect, which I think you would have to put her in an environment that has Infect as well. Although I really hope we never go back to a format that has Infect as a standard mechanic. I mean,
it'll probably be something along the lines of how Poison was. It'll just be like those one-shot deals that could maybe eventually kill you.
Sure, yeah. But as it stands, like, Standard Infect was just gross.
That was the first competitive deck I ever played.
I love Phyrexian Crusader. And keep in mind that, like, these are the expensive cards. So a really good example here is Crucible of Worlds, which is pushing $70 right now. And as long as you don't have, you know, a bunch of strip mine effects or fetch lands, Crucible becomes completely safe in Standard or Reprint. And it doesn't have any kind of theme tied to it. It's just the Crucible of Worlds. It's a big dome. So I'd be happy to see that reprinted. You kind of mentioned Planeswalkers earlier, Justin, about how they have to be kind of tied to a story. A lot of them originally weren't, so things like Elspeth could very easily come back. Elspeth's son, Knight Errant, I should say, could easily be reprinted. And Saffron makes the argument that if Gideon is good enough for Standard and safe for Standard, then Elspeth is absolutely safe for Standard. Because they're essentially the same Planeswalker.
Yeah, they're very similar. Now, with Elspeth Knight Errant, wasn't it she was the Knight Errant because of her role in Bant? So there was still like story tied to it.
Yeah, but nothing that was like,
yeah, there's nothing
allies. It doesn't particularly mention a mechanic tied to a certain, you know, block or anything like that. But I think you are right there. There's something about her title right there as something important there.
Though, yeah, I mean, you could get away with printing something, you know, that card, there's nothing in it. Like you said, that Chained Veil, even though there's no thematic components to Liliana the Chained Veil, like, that's definitely a card that can be reprinted, not because of power, well, because of power, but also because of, you know, story. It's like when she first got it.
Sure, yeah. And now, of course, there are other cards, you know, these fall into, like, the hate category. Leyline of Sanctity, Stony Silence, Engineered Explosives. They're all more impactful in other formats that aren't Standard. You know, Leyline of Sanctity, what would that do in Standard right now?
Pyromancer's Goggles would be useless.
Okay, that's one deck.
it's one of the top decks right now.
Right, but if I'm talking about Leyline, it has to go in a white deck.
Yeah.
Which you have Bant and you have...
Oh, no, like humans would love it.
Oh, yeah. Black Control would love it, too. But, like, Stony Silence is completely unplayable in some Standard formats. Like, there's just nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even remember... The only reason it was even in Innistrad was because we had just come off of Mirrodin Besiege block, where we had some artifacts that you could shut down with it. But other than that, completely safe to reprint. Probably not in a heavy artifact block, because that would just suck. You know, if you draft it and you just go, ha, 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 you know, 7 of my 10 opponents will just lose to this card on the spot. But yeah, like, so there's other cards like Keranos and Steel Overseer, Abrupt Decay, Restoration Angel, and Kitchen Finks, and Huntmaster, you know. All good cards. I think we can all agree on that in Modern, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But they're not so overpowered that you couldn't put them in Standard, right?
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Kitchen Finks and Restoration Angel is a sweet combo. I'm not going to deny that.
Yeah.
But we look at, like, Maelstrom Pulse. We have Declaration in Stone right now, which is a slight downgrade, but an upgrade at the same time of Maelstrom Pulse. Maelstrom Pulse is completely safe right now to reprint in Standard.
Yeah.
Like,
I just want a 4-mana Wrath, please.
Well, we'll... Those are coming up. Those are coming up. Even a card like Karn, you know, I'm obviously going off the example that he's giving us here. So if you guys have any examples of your own that you think would fall into these categories, please let me know. Even Karn, it's a 7-mana Planeswalker. And he didn't really do all that much in Standard, but when you give him, you know, turn 3 ability in Modern, he becomes a real player. So, like I said, a lot of these cards we're talking about here in this category of the safe cards, as long as you're smart about the design of Standard, go nuts. Like, there's not enough story to tie any of, well, a couple of these cards to their block that we couldn't see them again.
I want to see Counterspell in Standard.
We will never see Counterspell in Standard because they won't give it to us in Modern.
I know.
And it sucks.
Well, I mean, they could just do the, hey, here it is in Standard, BT dubs, immediately ban.
Yeah.
Kind of like what happened to Mental Misstep, except we actually got to play with that for a little bit to realize how degenerate that was.
Yeah, in Legacy, that was 6 months of absolute hell, as I understand it. God, I love Mental Misstep. Oh my God. All right, moving on to the borderline cards, and now these are getting to the point where things are a little bit more less defined. Warping in some environments, but probably okay in others. So we're moving away from the safe cards where as long as your environment is fit for it, you can print it here. And there's going to be a little bit of overlap, and so I think some cards could be moved one direction or the other from the twos and the threes. But right at the top of the list is a card that recently was banned in Modern, Eye of Ugin. Can't put that in Standard right now, right?
No, not at all.
Let's get that right out of the way.
Why not?
I don't know, Steven. What just happened in Modern?
Yeah, it was a great card back in original Zendikar.
It didn't do anything either.
Well, yeah, I shouldn't say great card. I don't mean like powerful card.
Right.
It was great in Standard because, you know, a casual player could get all these big, cool Eldrazi cards that cost 6 to 8 mana, some are 12, and be like, oh, cool, I've got a discount.
Yeah.
And a search.
Did you ever play back then, Steven? When Ivan was
first? No, I didn't. I was just being a little facetious, my apologies.
Oh. So, like, the funny thing about Eye of Ugin, I was playing on the most bare of casual levels. I had the most basic understanding of Magic. And I remember having some friends who complained about Eye of Ugin when it was printed in Worldwake. And everyone was going, what is this mythic land doing in the set that, what's an Eldrazi? They had no idea what was coming. And I just remember, and I think back to that now, going, wait if you just knew, guys. Have y'all just seen it coming because we got to Emrakul. So obviously we can't put Eye of Ugin in a format where even we have any remotely good colorless creature cards. Like that's just
I would say inexpensive colorless creatures.
Sure, yeah. And we just have to take a look at what happened in Modern to say that this card cannot be reprinted in a Standard set.
But it's really interesting because the only reason was because of the inexpensive Eldrazi. Like, Eldrazi Mimic, like, anything that was 5 mana below was basically just pushing.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it's probably safe in some formats, but not in others, which is kind of his umbrella statement about these borderline cards.
I actually think it would be very interesting if Eye of Ugin was in this current Standard, but every Eldrazi had an additional colorless to their mana cost.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that'd be really cool then. Just having, you know, blue and a true colorless and then 3 mana of any
color. Yeah, something like that.
I can see that. Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Now, what really bothers me about the Eye of Ugin is it makes colorless creatures cheaper.
Well, colorless Eldrazi. That's exactly what it does.
Well, the Eye of Ugin was supposed to be their prison. If anything, it should be making them more expensive. It should be a hate card. And it drives me crazy that their prison makes them easier to cast and to tutor for them.
I mean, yeah.
They were freed from the Eye of Ugin through Nicholas Bolas' shenanigan manipulations of Sarkhan, Jason, Chandra.
Yeah, I forget. Why the hell does it make it cheaper?
I bet it has something to do with the fact that's where they awaken from again. Because, I mean, it's like the flavor text. An eye closes, a race awakens.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense.
It's their rebirth into Zendikar.
Yeah.
I guess, but
it's like them getting in the fast lane. It's just doom, get out a little bit faster or something. I don't know. I'm thinking of like the eye being a birthing canal now, and that's really gross.
Well, I mean, it just basically do the same thing that the Hell Vault did.
Yeah.
Just like, ta-da, here's Eldrazi. Ta-da, here's Grizzlebrand.
Birthing canal, that was bad. That was really bad. Sorry, but
at least it wasn't pod related.
Oh jeez. Stop it, Steve.
So anyways, to through the breach.
Yeah. And so kinda like to back to Eye of Ugin here real quickly. So it's something that he points out in the article is that Wizards from the Hip, they show a lot about consistency, flavor, and story, which I think is a very, very good thing for a card game that's existed for 20 years. Telling a story is very important when a lot of your cards are just kind of a rehash of an old card in a lot of cases. But we see that coming to an end with core sets going away, and so something like Eye of Ugin would look weird in a different set. But I think at some point you kind of have to go, maybe that's okay. Maybe the Eye of Ugin could have shown up on Tark here. Because Ugin was also on Tark. You know, it's weird.
I mean, we could always just go back to Zendikar. I mean, we've already done it.
Right, and it could have been written in Zendikar, but like, you have to put it in the right format, the right set.
You definitely do.
So you change the flavor text a little bit. You know, you make it work. You know, make it work, like Tim Gunn says on Project Runway. Make it work. So if there's only one reprint of a modern staple and a standard block that has nothing to do with that standard block, just for the sake of pricing, because these are the most expensive cards in modern, is that okay? I mean, that's not the worst thing in the world. One card out of 270 cards.
I mean,
not the end of the world. Either.
Well, I mean, yeah, go for it. Sorry.
Oh no! I was just putting it out there. You know,
I was saying Justin.
Mechanically speaking, like, that's fine. But yeah. I don't know. I'm a lover of story. So if like the Eye of Ugin randomly showed up on Ravnica, I'm gonna need a damn good reason why it's there. They better like dedicate at least 3 story articles for why the Eye of Ugin is now on Ravnica.
Because he wants to be, and he wants to go hang out with his buddy Niv-Mizzet.
I was kind of thinking it'd be something along the lines like Emrakul somehow managed to like bring it with her slash him.
Oh yeah.
It.
Yeah. Well, let's. And then Emrakul's actually on the list as well here, paired up with Through the Breach. So, Through the Breach is probably a very safe card, even right now in Standard. Maybe not with Kozilek and Ulamog. Maybe not. But that's kind of what his point is. You know, if you are able to put in Emrakul or Grizzlebrand type cards, you know, we'll talk about modern reprints here, obviously. So, if you're Through the Breaching Emrakul or Grizzlebrand, things probably get a little warped. And there are probably a lot of places where you could put Through the Breach, and it would be just fine. Through the Breach in Scars of Mirrodin block. Probably okay. I mean, the biggest thing that you put into that, Wormcoil Engine. Okay, that's pretty fair.
And it also combos with the fact that it sacrifices itself at the end step.
Yeah, value. Steven gets it. And obviously, you know, it's an arcane spell, so you can like build around that, which is always neat. You know, you get to see that kind of comeback. Emrakul is also probably safe to put in a lot of formats, even though it is very much tied to a specific kind of block. But how much ramp is in your format? Can you reliably put Emrakul into play on turn 5 or 6? You know,
I think you're asking like 7 or 8.
Right. You know, I'm just thinking like, what's the danger zone? At that point, is Emrakul on turn 6 an absolute no-no? Like, that's modern speed right there at that point.
Yeah, well, if you're casting, of course.
Oh, yeah, you have to be able to cast it, obviously. You can't just be put it into play because that's where the real value comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of cool places where Emrakul could show up, and it's okay. You know, we've got White Weenie Dex, we got Emrakul, you know. We had
Blister. That could still very well be a thing.
Oh, yeah. It probably wouldn't care. It'd be like, all right, sack all of our lands. Our turn? Okay, kill you. We're always watching. We don't care. And now, yeah. And so let's kind of move on to some cards that, now, Steven, you talked about 4-mana rats, and there are those in this category of the borderline cards. So, like, Damnation and Oblivion Stone are the board wipes that are efficient in the sense that they're more efficient than the board wipes that Wizards is willing to put in Standard. Now, if we put Damnation in Standard, I'd be playing Standard, and that says something, I think. And that just pushes control decks back towards black, which, would you guys have that as warping to an extent?
Well, that was kind of the point that he had mentioned is, like, if you put those in, like, any deck can play Oblivion Stone if they want to, and then your control deck shift to black. Like, I think that's, like, the warping type of mentality he's referencing, but, like, whenever I was talking about the four-man stuff, it's like, I feel that that's what you need to like keep up right now. I think that's why it's important. I don't necessarily feel that taking either Damnation or Oblivion Stone and playing it because you can or playing it because you want to be the controlling black deck, I don't think that's a problem. I think that's just like the current direction Standard would be going.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like Languish, I think, is a perfectly fine example of a four-mana Wrath. It's up there with Mutilate. Back when we were in RTR block, where it was minus X to all creatures equal the number of swamps you control. It's like a great card.
Yeah, now that Siege Rhino is gone, though. Like, that was the biggest thing.
Yeah, Languish was completely unplayable at that point. Well, not I'm saying unplayable, just outclassed in general.
Yeah.
But I think we do have to kind of look at Damnation, Wrath of God, and just kind of accept the fact that Wizards is no longer going to reprint 4CMC Wraths with anti-regeneration ever again. And I think we're at peace with that.
And, you know, it's like, I don't see a huge issue with them printing 4-mana Wraths. Like, I mean, you don't do it every set. But if you want a more slow control grinding format, go for it.
You slow things down, like printing slower dual lands, so
exactly.
The whole deck isn't as fast, so that way Unconditional Wrath's
you know,
are better.
Like Wrath of God, yeah, that means that most controlling matches are going to have white in it.
Sure.
Damnation means they'll have black in it. Sure. You know, and that's okay, because sometimes we want white to be the controlling color. Sometimes we want black to be the controlling color. You know, that's okay.
Yeah, I've come to terms with there's never going to be another format of absolute wrath again.
They're never going to do it again. Well, I won't say never.
Yeah.
But for the foreseeable future, they're not going to do it. And that's fine, too.
Yeah.
But I would like to see it happen.
Oh, I absolutely would, too, because I want a Damnation reprint. I need more Damnations.
I might have one.
Not for $70, you know?
No, I might have one.
Okay. I gotcha.
If you're looking to trade.
I could be convinced. And then we get to come up with some of the more creatures here that could potentially cause some real problems. And his first examples are Voice of Resurgence, which I absolutely despise with a passion.
Will you play blue?
I do play blue. And a lot of people play blue. And Cavern of Souls, which could probably see reprints in Standard, and they're fine. They're not too problematic. But as far as gameplay is concerned, if Wizards really wants to push control, these become much more problematic. Cavern of Souls becomes a huge issue. You know, when Snapcaster Malik was the flavor of the day, and Wizards goes and prints Cavern of Souls and says, okay, guys, all of you green ramp decks, play your Primeval Titans on turn 4 now, uncounterably, you're welcome. You know, that isn't a huge problem for Wizards because they have shown us that creatures are much more important than spells right now. And they don't want the draw go of Standard years of past to be a thing, which is fine. It's whatever.
But I don't know. Like, I still feel like you should have decks of that nature available.
Oh, I think so too. But I think we've gone past the days of the blue-black mirror or the blue-white mirror, trade blows of on your end step, think twice. On your end step, Forbidden Alchemy. On your end step, okay, I'm going to Snapcaster Forbidden Alchemy. Okay, I'm going to counter your spells now. And just true draw-go magic. I mean, we just don't see that in Standard anymore. And I think that's probably okay from not only a design standpoint, not only from a playability standpoint, but also from a viewing standpoint. Because I would have friends who come watch me play at FNM, and I'm in a blue-black mirror. Shout out to Dylan Temple. You know we did it big. And we have nothing on the board but lands. And we're just... Draw a card. Flashback, Thought Scour. Or think twice. Draw another card. Okay. And just draw a card. And that's all we were doing until it got to the point where it's like, all right, hands have gassed up. It's go time. Business spell. Counter. That's not like something entertaining to watch. You want to see big creatures like Siege Rhinos and Pelucanoses button heads, and you guys hear where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like the board stall moments that like we got with the bank company mirror taking what, like two and a half hours?
That is
like, I mean, It can happen both ways. And I don't know, I kind of feel like you're alienating a group of players. I mean, you're just changing how it works.
Which is what I'm talking about. Like, we need to be in this balanced state where, you know, yes, spells are powerful and they do exciting things, but then so do creatures.
Yeah. And I think we're at a pretty good medium right now.
I still feel like we're leaning pretty heavily on creatures.
Oh, we most definitely are, but, like, I think it's just because the spells go so... they complement the creature so well. Collected Company is a really good example of that, and a card that I am sick and tired of seeing in Modern, and, you know, kind of going back to those that we talked about earlier, I was watching a match between a... I think it was a Splinter Twin player and Collected Company player in Modern, and the Collected Company player drew more cards and got more value than the Splinter Twin player did, just because he was able to go Collected Company... hit a kitchen fix, hit an internal witness, get back my collected company, and just loop the cycle over and over. Which, if the spells keep going like that, I think Justin's absolutely right. We need to find a way to balance that better.
Mm-hmm.
But
because right now our most powerful spells are all about creature value.
Yeah, but more about that another day. But yeah, so cards like Voice and Counter Souls, you know, they're going to impact Wizard Magic for 18 months. It would have an impact, but it's not the end of the world. But they're going to have a pretty big impact. He'll see a couple more cards here, like Knight of the Reliquary, Kiki Jiki, Spell Sky, Gaddock Teague. And these become the borderline cards that are really kind of more towards the opposite end, where they're almost unsafe. Knight of the Reliquary is good at any format that has Forest and Plains. Period. But when you have good utility lands like Keswick Wolf Run or Cavern of Souls or anything like that, it becomes not just a big beater. It becomes a much more powerful weapon. Kiki Jiki is good because it can copy a lot of creatures and get you some value, but when you are Kiki Jikiing Siege Rhino or Kitchen Finks or Snapcaster Mage, or like Reflector Mage. That's a Reflector Mage every single turn. Like, that can't be fun, right?
No, not at all. Back on the Knight of the Reliquary real quick, it also cannot exist in a standard format with fetches.
Yep.
Yeah, that's very true, yeah. I mean, it's really big, but beyond just being a big beater, you know what? If it existed right now, I think it'd be fine with fetch lands. Or even, well, they don't have fetch lands, but if it did, you know, we still have Reflector Mage just to undo, you know, the 10-10 that you all of a sudden have.
Oh, that's not counters. That's just +1/+1.
Oh, yeah, I know. But just, you know, you have to be able to attack with it at least once, and you've got Crassus. But I definitely see the argument there for sure. But yeah, just a Kiki Jiki that can make you a Reflector Mage every single turn, that's absurd, but... it also costs 5 mana and 3 of them are red. it's a little less of a better example, or it's a little less problematic because it's so hard to cast. But let's look at a thing like Spellskites, which is an undeniably powerful card in Modern right now because of its ability to fight Infect, Burn, and Boggles. But Phyrexian mana is kind of an issue. Like, Steven, you guys weren't around when Phyrexian mana was actually in Standard.
I was not around.
Oh, I was at the tail end of that.
Oh, okay, so you kind of got a taste of it in Standard.
Yep.
It sucked. It sucks even worse in Modern. It sucked even worse than that in Legacy and Vintage. So a card like that probably can't come back anytime soon. And I wish there was... where do you go into more depth about it other than just the obvious? Oh, there it is. But yeah. It's probably safe for Standard, but since Phyrexian mana was such a mistake of a mechanic, I don't think you could put this back into Standard.
It was such a cool concept.
Oh yeah, well, in the cards that it makes, that it was flavorful in, like Birthing Pod, where you're paying life to get life out of death, like that's a very cool concept. When you're snapping it on Dismember, that's not fun.
Yeah.
Gut Shots and Mental Missteps, that's not fun anymore. I mean, I don't think it is. All right, but let's...
I think Gutshot's fine.
Gutshot's okay, I think. Now let's get to some more, to a couple other cards here. We got Inquisition of Kozilek. Far less warping, but it's probably still too good for standard.
I actually disagree. I mean, like, we have transgressed the mind right now, which is just the reverse of that. And I would say that transgress is probably better than Inquisition, given the current standard format, just because of how mid-range it is.
Yeah.
And, like, we not only have transgress the mind, we also have despise and duress.
Well, duress. Despise rotated.
Oh, sorry, despise rotated. Okay, yeah. So a couple months ago, we had all three in standard. So, I mean, to say that, you know, Inquisition of Kozilek is too good for standard.
Right.
When we have 12, or sorry, when you could potentially have 12 copies of discard spells.
And that's very true, but again, like, these are the cards that are just on the border. That might get there, but might not. But I definitely agree with that right there. Now, how about Liliana of the Veil? She's $100 freaking, the single most expensive card in Modern. Oh, no. Tarmogoyf, I'm sorry. But she's potentially safe, but also potentially incredibly warping. Can you imagine madnessing every single turn?
Yeah, no, you can't put her in a format with madness. I'm a little bit more on the side of this card probably should never be reprinted, despite story. Like, you know, if it just said Liliana Vess.
Oh, sure.
Like, I would still probably doesn't belong in standard.
Yeah,
I actually think she would be fine because you have Jace, Brin's Prodigy, and everyone thought he was going to be bonkers with Madness, and like he's been okay. Like he hasn't been fantastic, but like just the shell that the deck is around, like it.
Oh yeah,
he's not the primary reason. It's like nuts.
He's only got a couple of turns to do his Madness. Liliana is a Madness every single turn. Mm-hmm. And it's a symmetrical, well, technically it's supposed to be asymmetrical because it goes with the value out of it better than your opponent does.
Yeah.
But can just imagine, plus one Liliana, Fiery Temper. Plus one Liliana, play Incorrigible Use. You know, whatever it's going to be.
But like even then, like I don't think the madness spells are actually powerful enough to warrant her being too ridiculous right now.
And that I agree with. I definitely agree with that for sure. But it's a hard to imagine. I do remember that there was rumors of her being printed in M15 as the Black Planeswalker.
Yeah, and then they realized that Mono Black Devotion would have just like eaten her up.
Yeah. But hey, it'd be cool to see her come back. You know, she is awesome and powerful, but I think you gotta be careful about Planeswalkers in particular.
I personally like them reinventing the Planeswalkers every time they reprint them.
Oh yeah, I do too. I would rather see new Planeswalkers than old ones. It's a very good example.
I don't mean new as in like unique, just like, for example, multiple Jaces. Like, I like that, you know, we get the same guy, he does something similar, but in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Nahiri is breaking into Modern a little bit with that new Emrakul Jeskai deck. You know, I want to see new Planeswalkers doing new cool things and new versions of the old ones doing new cool things. You know, it's real easy to teach an old Planeswalker a new trick.
Oh, okay.
and the last card that I want to really touch on here is a card like Academy Ruins, which has become stupidly expensive because of the unbanning of Thopter Sword. And now if you put it in a format with a few artifacts, it's okay. Lots of artifacts, like in Scars of Mirrodin, things get out of control.
I would go so far to say that Academy Runes could be okay in an artifact heavy set as long as it's not full of artifact creatures.
Or any artifact for that matter. I mean, artifacts in general, just because of how Okay, go ahead, Zane.
No, and like I agree with Justin on this one. Like even though it has a powerful effect, like you also have to consider that that is your card for the turn. And like in standard, while that's probably a little, I don't know. I'd probably say it's on par with how Lantern Control uses it. Like if you were to have something similar in standard, it wouldn't necessarily be backbreaking unless we had warm coil, really.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was going. If it's in a format like Scars of Mirrodin, where the artifacts are the crux of the format, where it is Warm Coil Engine, where it's the sword cycle, where it's Batter's Holes, things like that, where it's just, oh, you blew it up, well, put it back on top. Oh, I drew it again, great, all the value in the world.
Which, once again, I think that's fine. Like, let's say this got reprinted with a set of swords, Sword of Fire and Ice, mm-hmm. Feast of Hammond, etc. You know, it's like, yeah, you get a lot of value of being able to get your Sword of Fire and Ice back, but it's not like pulling a Worm Coil Engine where it's just like, oh geez, he just made a Lifelink and Death Touch worm and now he gets to play the damn thing again.
Right. But yeah. And again, it could be warping. Within the right Scars of Mirrodin esque
yeah.
set, things are okay. But obviously Wizards would want to put cool, flashy artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you blow up my Blightsteel Colossus, oh no problem, I'll just put it back on top of my library with the shuffle effect on the stack.
To be fair, what deck is going to be able to play Blightsteel outside of a control deck?
That's very
like, just naturally wants to get to left.
There's lots of angles to show look at this from, but
yeah.
But again, these are the cards that are just on the edge of this might be too good, and in this format, it's not okay.
Yeah.
So. Definitely, it's a cool card. I love playing it in Modern now. I love being able to loop my Crucible of Worlds because people like to love that card, apparently. I don't know. All right, so let's go on to the last section here, which is oddly labeled number 5, I guess because of the extreme factor, but this is level 4. These are the absolutely never going to reprint these cards. They would warp in all formats. There's not a standard format where this would not work. Or this would work, I should say. And right at the top of the list, he's got Ensnaring Bridge, Worship, Ghostly Prison, Blood Moon, and Magus of the Moon. Each of these go in a very specific style of Modern deck, but I cannot for the life of me imagine a world where you want to see these in Standard again.
I can see Blood Moon.
I also think Ensnaring Bridge would also be really interesting because if you're the control deck against the aggro and you have Ensnaring Bridge and you don't have cheap things to dump your hand, you're gonna have cards in your hand on three anyway. It's not gonna be a surefire gotcha.
Right.
And then, but with Blood Moon, like a lot of the standard decks right now play a lot more basics than Modern decks do. So it's not nearly as, you know, oppressive as it is in Modern. I'm not saying that, like, it's a card that should be reprinted often. I'm not saying it's a card that should be looked at for most sets. But, like,
right.
For example, in two-color formats,
mm-hmm.
that's not a bad card.
Right, but Blood Moon is an example of a card that is a hate card on something that Wizards wants you to be doing, like casting your spells and playing
mm-hmm.
creatures. If this is any format where the mana bases are even just a tiny bit restricted, like let's pull up like Green White Tokens for an example. Let's pull up that list real quick.
Okay.
Come on, Internet, go. All right. So if we look at let's look at the Milwaukee Classic lists. Okay, so Naya Midrange, for example, the deck that won the tournament has 6 basics. If it doesn't draw those basics, the game is over. And there are no cheap mana accelerants like Arbor Elves
mm-hmm.
or Birds of Paradise to get you out of that lock. It's a hate in the wrong
yeah.
kind
and
of way.
Once again, I think that it would be fine in a 2-color format where most decks are 2 colors.
Yeah, and that's true. But as long as Wizards wants to print cool dual lands that
yeah.
have certain effects, you want to play those dual lands, and you don't want to say, hey, don't play these dual lands because this one enchantment's going to ruin your day.
That's fair. Like, I can
although,
see...
Oh, go ahead, Steven.
I think... you could put Blood Moon in a situation where you have various fetch lands, like not necessarily the Zendikar Onslaught fetches, but like of some sort of equivalent, because that way it's teaching newer players to that, like sometimes it's okay to just go get your basics. Like you don't always have to have the like the maximum amount of mana efficiency, which I mean like you should, but if you know that Blood Moon is lingering, then that, you know, teaches you another aspect of the game. It's like, all right, is my opponent most likely going to have Blood Moon in their sideboard? Should I make this a consideration whenever I go fetch out my lands? Like, I think it would be an interesting learning experience for them if they saw it as that, not just a, oh, this card's keeping me from doing my one.
Or an absolutely miserable learning experience.
And I mean, we can go ahead and step it down to Magus of the Moon, because that card's far more removable.
Oh, sure, sure.
So, I mean, like, well, you know, let's say Magus of the Moon instead of Blood Moon. Let's say Blood Moon's unacceptable. You know, Magus of the Moon, it has a very powerful effect. It's removable in a two-color format. Once again, it cannot be a three- or four-color format where it's reprinted. I think it would be fine. Like,
yeah.
It would definitely be on the powerful side. It would definitely be a card that people have to play around, but I think it's okay to have cards that people have to play around.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with that. You know, Saffron goes on to make the point that he's with you guys as well, that it's theoretically possible to design a standard environment where they could be, you know, safe somewhat, but that's a lot of effort going into making sure that, you know, new players coming into the game have to worry about a game that, you know, thanks to cards like Worship or Stand or Blood Moon or even Ghost Prison to an extent, completely locks what they're able to do.
Yeah, no,
and
I don't think that
they want to turn off new players by saying, because this card exists, if you make the mistake of being kind of cool with your mana base, or you don't play a certain kind of removal spell in your deck, or whatever it is, the game can't actually be won anymore. I think that is the nail in the coffin for new players.
Yeah, 100%. Now, I don't think that Worship or Ghostly Prison should ever be reprinted into Standard, just because they do have that ability to say you're not allowed to win the game anymore.
Yeah.
Blood Moon does that, but it doesn't. Magus of the Moon does that, but it doesn't.
It's still debatable, but I think that these five cards really kind of form and a group that just says the game is no longer fun because you were doing something specific.
Yeah.
I think that's what they want to avoid here. But let's move on to a card that is near and dear to my heart. I'm sure Steven can see it on his screen too. Snapcaster Mage. Never in a million years do I want to see this card back in Standard because of what it says about the decision process of designing that set. You want to... they put it in the set, right? They're making a decision to power down spells. If you put Unsummon in the set with Snapcaster Mage, Unsummon becomes one of the best cards in the set. Because it's so easy to just go, Unsummon your guy, Snapcaster, Unsummon your guy, or Unsummon my Snapcaster Mage, replay it, counter spell, whatever it's going to be. I can't think of an environment where Snapcaster is a safe reprint. Imagine being Bank Company right now.
It would be awful.
Yeah. I'm gonna collect a company, hit a Snapcaster Mage, flashback this other collected company, and hit two more cards.
Yeah,
it's
too good. I love the card, but yeah, it doesn't belong in Standard again.
Yeah, I'm going to agree on that.
What was it even that backbreaking whenever it was in Standard? Like, I remember the best counterspell was Mana Leak, and then you also had
Dissipate.
Dissolve
wasn't one of them, but you know, three mana counterspells. You could probably make a Standard format where he wasn't the best card, but you don't want to do that, I don't think. You want to make an environment where Snapcaster Mage is cool and awesome.
That might be your bias speaking, though.
Well, you look at the card. You play the card in Modern for crying out loud.
I love the card. It's one of it's one of the reasons why I'm considering going to Control.
Yeah,
you should. However, I just don't think that it's a card that should be reprinted in Standard, and if it was reprinted, it would need to be in a situation where it's not the best card.
But it has to be, because it is. Moving on to Thoughtseize. I think it goes without saying that Thoughtseize is a warmat, is a format warping card. Can we can all agree on that, right?
No.
No.
So I found this argument really interesting because it's like, all right, we have the experience of Thoughtseize telling us that it's too backbreaking. It's like, all right, well, let's look back to whenever we had Thoughtseize. Thoughtseize was backbreaking whenever it was followed by a pack rat because of how powerful pack rat was in that context of the two cards. So, like, the... I don't feel like Thoughtseize in this current format would be fine. I mean, like, we already are seeing Duress and Transgress the Mind, like, from the Jund style decks. And even, like, back whenever you had the Jeskai Black and stuff, they weren't running, they were running, like, what, three of Duresses, or at least, like, the Abzan Red and things like that. Like, I don't feel that having a Thoughtseize effect or having actual Thoughtseize is that bad for a format. It just depends on what's around it.
Right, that's a really good example. And you know, the other example he uses with Thoughtseize is Mutavault, another completely warping card because it went in with the Pack Rat deck. It went in the Mono Blue Devotion deck that would just get powered.
Which one was Mutavault printed in again?
M13, I believe?
Yeah.
Or 14.
Yeah, M13, I think.
Yeah. And I think, and he makes a really good point here talking about how the fear that they have now of modern reprints because of things like Mutavault and Thoughtseize is that Wizards is going to kind of hold back the cards that are safe, that we talk about Kitchen Fix and Huntmaster and cards like that, that are safe to reprint just because of this one reaction. And I don't think that's the way to go with things. They don't want to knee jerk and just go, oh, this was a bad idea. We should just not do anything fun ever again. but they had to learn from that and kind of go, you know, let's make smarter decisions and maybe not put Thoughtseize in a format where, you know, Packard exists.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Mutavault is fine as long as we're not completely we're not like all in on the tribal theme. Like,
Mutavault doesn't
belong anywhere near Lorwyn set.
Yeah.
Also, if you consider, I know. If Mutavault would have been in this past standard, like, what, the past, like, I don't know, 6 months we've had, it would not have been played as heavily. I don't feel like.
Yeah, because only 3-color mana bases couldn't support it with all the fetch lines they needed.
Yep.
Pointless.
Also, as a quick clarifier, Mutavault was an M14, so forgot about how the year is ahead of the current year.
Yeah. I'm just trying to remember what sets were been surrounding. I wasn't playing at the time.
You had RTR block and Theros block as kind of the, because that's where the mono black, that's where the devotion decks came from.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had all those hybrid mana cards from Ritual of Ravnica that just paired up really nicely with Grey Merchant, Master of Waves, all the gods, you know. Magic was sweet back then. It was simpler. One color, that's all we needed. Now, let's look at the last section of cards that he has here, and there are some doozies and some personal favorites of mine. Tarmogoyf, Arcbound Ravager, Goblin Guide, Full Mana Mage, Wormcoil Engine, Dark Confidant, Vendilion Click. We can all agree that they have one thing in common. They're stupidly powerful, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree on these. Although, I still think Tarmogoyf is another one of those, like, corner case things.
Oh, he really is. Tarmogoyf is so bad in Standard, except right now, because if they want to make Delirium a thing, Tarmogoyf is the Delirium poster child.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. It was like, do we get him?
Yeah.
I was really shocked when we didn't get him.
He just doesn't make... But what is a Lurgoyf on the Innistrad? Like, what does that even mean?
What is a Lurgoyf, period?
Yeah.
What's a freaking Gitrog monster?
It's a giant frog.
Oh, it's a frog? Because that makes sense.
Exactly. Like, it's just a monster.
I mean, they could, like, errata his creature type to be, like, horror or something. But anyway. The point thing about these cards is that they are so generically powerful
mm-hmm.
that in any way, you know, they're all just good at what they do because they're just it's a generic just power punch of power. Regardless of what standard format they're in, they are the best in that format, I think. And they're just it makes a good argument that I completely agree with. They're too efficient and too resilient for standard to handle. And I just don't think that they will ever see a light of day in standard again. Even Sigarda, which is a kind of an odd one here. Like Sigarda is way too powerful for standard to deal with right now, I think.
I think Goblin Guide is actually okay.
Well, I mean, Vanilla Click is probably, and he actually lists them in order of what he could probably be reprinted. And, you know, so at number 8, and this is from the bottom of being the most likely to the least likely. Tarmogoyf is the most least likely. Dark Confidant, Vendilion Click, Worm Coil, Goblin Guide, Sigarda, Flamander Mage, Arcbound Manager. And that's kind of his order of cards that could be reprinted. And Vendilion Click could see play. Like, it'd be a really good card right now, but it's just so good at what it does.
I think that would be more disgusting than Snapcaster and Bank Company.
Oh, what if they were both in the format at the same time?
No. We can't do that. We have to do the hypothetical one-ups.
This is my apartment.
Not anymore.
What if we made a Bant Wizard company that can modern, that can collect a company into Vendilion Click and Snapcaster Mage?
And then what if it had Delver in it? And Mana Leak, and oh wait, we're not playing Modern.
Well, we don't put Delver in it because that's not very good. But if you put like Tarmogoyf in there too, and oh, you can make it be like Sultai colored and hit Fulminator Mage and Dark Combat. This thing sounds like fun. Anyway, moving on. Hits a couple of more cards here. You know, we have Mutavault, Ink Moth Nexus, Blink Moth Nexus. They're just too good to be played in Standard, I think. We don't want, In fact, maybe that's just a bad idea, probably. Then we move down to Aether Vial, Mox Opal, Chalice of the Void, and Batterskull. Would you guys want to be in any standard format where these cards still exist?
Aether Vial, yes.
What?
The other thing?
because you play a bunch of cheap creatures.
The fact that it makes those creatures uncounterable is a kicker for me.
I mean, that's because like Moxable and Aether Vial are both broken in the fact that they cheat mana, and that's something that just isn't acceptable in Standard anymore by any stretch of the imagination. Chalice of the Void is just it's almost safe enough, but if you get to the situation like we have right now where mono white humans is a thing where it's a bunch of one drops, Chalice for one. Go.
Ta-da.
Yeah. Like my trick? Start from the bird to all of them. Batterskull, it's just too hard to deal with. I mean, it's probably okay in a format right now where we have Kolaghan's Command, but it's just play Batterskull. Oh, rule spell, bounce Batterskull. Play Batterskull, rule spell, oh, bounce Batterskull. It gets degenerate after a while.
Yeah, which, like, Aether Vial, like I said, is the only one where I'm okay with.
Sure. But again, these are all colorless cards, too, where they can just go in any deck they want to.
And, like, it might be a bias for the Aether Vial, but I don't really see it being too much of a problem. There would be a deck built around it, but
clearly, I know you didn't play Standard back then, but there
just
was a deck built around Batterskull. It was called Skullblade.
No, not Batterskull. I said that one would be problematic. Aether Vial is the one that I'm like,
it goes into mono white humans. It goes into Bank Company. They're all 2 and 3 drops.
They are all 2 and 3 drops. But then, what are you giving up?
It's not much, I don't think.
You have to choose between removal or that.
It'd probably be like when Company rotates, that would be what replaces it.
Oh, sure, yeah. But I you change a couple of numbers. It doesn't even seem like a downside anymore.
Well, you could not play Jace.
Yeah?
Yeah, but then you're down to 24 creatures. Or, sorry, not 24.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, obviously you change numbers a little bit, but we've seen in Modern where if you can play both Collective Company and Court of Calling, you play both. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, finding the numbers and just kind of going from there.
Yeah, but you also have, once again, better creatures there.
Okay, yeah, sure. But within a standard format, are these creatures not just good enough? Things like Bounding Crassus and Duskwalker Creature, like these cards are already good enough in standard.
They're fantastic creatures, don't get me wrong. But if I have eight, you know, cheap creature in spells, that, well, for Coco to work, I need to have at minimum 25 castable creatures. Or not castable, fetchable creatures.
Okay.
At minimum. So with 25 creatures, and we need to make sure that we get our fourth land drop on turn four. Means we need 24 to 25 lands as well. We have very, very limited space for spells. Which is why you see most of these decks have 8 to 10 spells in them.
Yeah.
So if we lose Dromoka's Command, we lose a lot of power there.
I see that. I see the argument there. But I think there is a configuration to see that happen. You know, you already can trim lands because you're playing Aether Vial, because all of your spells are now effectively free. Once you put it on three, it's whatever I want to put into play is now on the table.
But once again, we have to get that turn four cooked up.
Yeah, I understand that. Like I said, I think there is a configuration of spells to make this very reasonable, very, you know, very scary, very quick. I don't see basketball again anyway. That card's just scary. And he kind of wraps up the article talking about a couple other warping cards that I disagree with, but at the same time I understand. Bitter Blossom, Pact of Negation, Noble Hierarch, Gifts Ungiven, and Cryptic Command. Steven, I know you've played a few of these cards in your time. I know you're a Cryptic Command fan. I mean, what would that do to Standard in your opinion?
Give control a chance.
Oh, yes. Aside from the obvious, you know, that just becomes a really annoying thing to play around, you know. If it's a creature battle, you know, go to combat. Oh, tap your
gotcha.
Draw a card. I'm the best magic player in the world. Kill you on the backswing. You know, cards like this just create... They're either so efficient... Again, you know, they're so efficient in what they do. And then, you know, we look at Pact and Cryptic Command, which are just... They're victims of Wizards not liking counter spells anymore. You know, the best one we've had recently is Silumgar Scorn, which is a great card, but it's a lot of hoops to jump through at the same time. You know, not power level warping on that sense, but they're just, you don't want a bunch of people to be like, oh, he had Cryptic Command. Again. He counted my spell. Again. Whatever it's going to be.
Gosh, I remember when I first started the Niv-Mizzet combo deck, because this was Cold Snap Time Spiral, and...
Oh, we're going way back then. Okay.
Original Ravnica.
Sure, sure.
The Ophidian Eye Niv-Mizzet deck. It was Niv-Mizzet, Ophidian Eye, and Counterspells.
Yeah.
And that was it. And like, I was a new player. I was a casual player, and I just could not enjoy myself playing against that deck. And it was every time I sat down and they played a blue out, you know, I was just ready to be like, okay, I'm done with this round. I'll wait to play the next one.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you guys think? Steve, I'll go to you first. What are your thoughts on, you know, this statement that Morrow made about that all modern cards are too warping?
I think that he's very wrong.
Go ahead, Steven.
I agree. I feel like they shouldn't be afraid to up the power level of any certain format or give these ridiculous cards. I feel like it's entertaining to find those cards and find a way to break them, but have it be to where the card isn't broken in the sense that that's the only thing you should be doing in that standard environment.
Yeah.
And I will hedge back a little bit from what he said. I do like that they are cautious about raising the power level. I think they are overly cautious, but
have you seen Siege Rhino? That wasn't cautious at all. That was just bleh.
Yes, mistakes are made from time to time, but you know, it's like we aren't playing with Yu-Gi-Oh now, where they went from, I don't know, like when I see Yu-Gi-Oh players playing. And if you play Yu-Gi-Oh, guys, you know, that's cool. but
no, it's not.
Anyways, you know, they now have all of these extra rules, and they're constantly coming up with things to increase the power of cards. And when I first played Yu-Gi-Oh! When I was in like seventh grade,
he admits it. He's a traitor.
When I was in seventh or eighth grade, before I discovered how great Magic was.
There you go.
I'm in the same boat here, just saying.
Yeah, I've played too. I have to admit, nobody's perfect.
Like, the game did powerful things, but not near... If I took any of the decks that I had played with back then against these decks that are played now, like, they wouldn't do anything to those decks. I mean, I've seen turn two kills. It looks like everyone's playing Vintage with degenerate infinite combo decks. It's just ridiculous.
Yep.
And Magic has kept its ability to be a strategic game, to be a game where it's not who gets their combo out first, by avoiding this power creep. And so I do appreciate that, but I do think that they're sometimes overly cautious with what they do and do not reprint.
Yeah, I completely agree. And just going by the numbers, Sakharov found that it is overwhelmingly incorrect what Mauro said. You know, there is a little pie chart, and it's less than 25%. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It is... Okay, it's a little over 25%. There are 25 cards that he found that are just so warping they could not be reprinted ever again. Again, he mentioned that there's a lack of precise language, you know, saying that all of them is probably wrong. Some of them are okay. But when you combined the phrases vast majority and horribly warping like he did, that's where you paint... It paints Modern in a very flawed sense. You know, like, all the cards in Modern are just busted, and we can never see them again. So sorry. Too bad. and that's certainly not true. I mean, there are plenty of Modern cards that we talk about tonight, even more than we talk about tonight, that are just perfectly fine to see reprinting in Modern. And I think you guys would agree with that.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So, yeah. That's all I got for the night. Yes, we are hitting a very long episode. I realize that now.
No worries. Good to know.
I thought we were going for kind of short. Oh well. It's a big topic to hit on though. So I definitely I really think it was worth kind of going into all of this. So I definitely it's a cool discussion to have, and I think that as we continue to see new sets, that we see was its philosophy towards cards like this. To kind of shift, and we get to see reprints of these cards because a lot of them are a lot of fun to play with, and I don't think you should just restrict things like Elspeth and Scapeshift to Modern.
Yeah,
cool. So yeah, I think that about wraps it up for this week's episode. Big thanks to my two Bard co-hosts, Mr. Spellpierce and Mr. Forkenrath, for coming and hanging out with us tonight. Appreciate you guys.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me back again.
As always. Mm-hmm. Thanks again. Appreciate you, Stephen, for taking time out of your science stuff schedule.
I am right now at the tail end of the semester. So all I have is one test and two papers. The light is at the end of the tunnel.
The light is at the end of the tunnel. I'm going to bring you to light, Stephen. What's your CMC? Are you a 5-drop?
I don't know. This semester's been pretty dense.
I mean, if he's just about done with school, I think we need a Steven Science Corner every week.
I'm okay with that.
Oh man.
One every week, Steven. Make it happen.
I can happily go over my papers and whatnot, but I'm sure, in the best interest of our listeners, I will refrain.
Refrain? That is fair. How considerate of you. Well, as always, you can listen to us every week over on MTG Cast and all the other great casts that are on there. You can find us on Facebook. Just search the EOT Newsflash Network. Send us your episode ideas, topic ideas, whatever you want to talk to us about. Thoughts and concerns, always appreciated. You can find us on Twitter at EOT Newsflash and send us emails at EOTNewsflash@gmail.com. And Stephen, I'm going to let you take it out with the thing that you like to do every week.
You mean the thing that we do again? So let's do it again?
Let's do it again! We're gonna do it again next week, Steven. I think it's a good idea.
Oh, I'm ready.
I'm ready. Are you ready? It's only next week. We're already ready. Let's do it. All right, guys. Thanks for listening to us, and we'll talk to you guys next week.